I'm better at riding mules.
Son, we're fresh out, Augustus said. Can either you boys shoot?
No, but we can dig potatoes, Alan said. He didn't want the man to think that they were totally incompetent.
You boys took the wrong ship, Augustus said. I doubt there's 10 spuds in this whole country.
He caught them the gentlest horses out of the small bunch that were still penned, taught them how to adjust their stirrups so their feet wouldn't dangle. He hadn't had time for that refinement in Sabinus. Just then Jake came walking along, Winchester in the crook of his arm. No doubt he had concluded that it would be easier to stay up all night than to explain to Call why he hadn't. Soon the Irishmen were mounted and were cautiously walking their mounts around the pen.
It's new to them, but they are a quick-witted race, Augustus said. Give them a week and they'll be riding like Comanches.
I don't know that I'll pause a week, Jake said. You boys have got hard to tolerate. I might take that yellow-haired gal and mosey off to California.
Jake, you're a darn grasshopper, Augustus said. You ride in yesterday talking Montana, and today you're talking California.
Once the Irishmen had got fairly competent at mounting and dismounting, Augustus gave them each a Winchester and made them shoot at a cactus a time or two.
You got to learn sometime, he said. If you can learn to ride and shoot before Captain Call gets back, he might hire you.
The O'Brien boys were so awed to find themselves with deadly weapons in their hands that they immediately forgot to be nervous about their horses. Sean had never held a gun before, and the flat crack of the bullet when he shot at the cactus was frightening. It occurred to him that if they were expected to shoot, they could also expect to be shot at, an unappealing thought.
Do we ask their names before we shoot them? He inquired.
It ain't necessary, Augustus assured him. Most of them are named Jesus, anyway.
Well, I ain't named Jesus, Jake said. You boys try and not do your learning in my direction. I've been known to get riled when I'm shot at. When the two Irishmen came trotting up to the horse herd behind Augustus and Jake, Dish Bogat could hardly believe his eyes. He had always heard that the Hat Creek outfit was peculiar, but arming men who didn't even know how to dismount from their horses was not so peculiar as insane. Augustus took the lead on a big white horse named Puddinfoot, and Jake Spoon followed him. Jake looked sour as clabber, which suited Dish fine. Maybe Lorena hadn't fallen quite in love with him after all. Dish rode over and poked Newt, who was asleep on his horse. Dish himself had napped from time to time, the day being hot and the horse herd placid. "You ought to see what's coming," he said. "Gus has put them darn midgets a horseback." Newt had a hard time getting his eyes open. As soon as the chase was over, sleep had begun trying to pull him down. If Pedro Flores had ridden up and offered to shoot him, he didn't think he would much care, since it would at least mean more sleep. He knew cowboys were supposed to be able to stay in the saddle 2 or 3 days at a stretch without sleep, but he was guiltily aware that he had not yet learned the trick. When Dish poked him, his hat fell off, and when he got down to get it, his legs felt as heavy as if somebody had put lead in his boots. He would have liked to say something to Sean O'Brien, who looked as tired as he was, but he couldn't think of a word to say. Augustus, who had no chance to examine Call's big catch, rode into the herd and eased through to the other side, where Dietz and Pee were waiting. He took his time about it, giving the animals a critical inspection as he went past. Not more than 40 of them struck him as prime mounts. A lot were undersized, some had saddle sores, and the whole bunch of them were skinny from overwork or underfeeding, or probably no feeding. Except for a prize stud or two, Pedro Flores had probably never wasted an oat on a horse in his life.
"These nags is barely worth a night's sleep," he said to Dietz and Pee. "If we was aiming to start a soap factory, they might do, but so far as I know, we ain't. I've a notion to keep the best 50 and run the rest off."
"My Lord," Pee said, aghast at what Gus had suggested. "The captain would shoot all of us if we run off any of these horses."
"I don't doubt he'd foam at the mouth," Augustus said. "What do you think, Dietz?"
"They skinny," Dietz said.
Might get fat if we give him enough time. You might grow wings if I give you enough time, Augusta said.
They looked across the river, and the sun was slipping fast. In an hour or two, they could expect a loud visit.
Here's the plan, he said. Pedro won't bother coming to town, knowing our habits like he does. We'll pin the prime stock and hide the skinny little rabbits up in some thicket. Then if we don't like the looks of his army, we can skedaddle and let him drive his own soap factory back home.
P.I. felt deeply uneasy about the plan. When the captain was around, things were done in a more straightforward fashion. Gus was always coming up with something sly. However, P.'s opinion hadn't been asked. He watched as Gus and Dietz began to cut the herd. Soon Dish Bogat figured out what was happening and rode over to help him. Dish was always a willing hand, except when it came to digging wells. Jake sat with the boy and the Irishman and watched the proceedings without much interest. He had himself a smoke, but didn't offer anybody else one. Newt watched, too, trying to decide if he ought to go help. Mr. Gus, Dietz, and Dish were doing the work so efficiently he decided he'd just be in the way, so he stayed put, hoping that Jake would say something to him. But there had been no chance to renew their friendship since Jake had come home. As sunset approached, Newt felt more and more anxious. The captain being gone always affected him that way. He knew Mr. Gus was supposed to be one of the coolest hands on the border, and he was confident Jake could handle practically anything that came up, but despite those two, he couldn't stop himself from feeling anxious when the captain was gone. Young Sean O'Brien felt anxious, too, only his anxiety was of a different nature. The prospect of shooting and being shot at had loomed larger and larger in his thinking until he could think of little else. Since Newt looked friendly, he decided to seek his counsel on the matter. "What part of a man is best to shoot at?" he asked, addressing himself to Newt. Jake Spoon chuckled. "His horse," he said. "Just aim for his horse. There ain't many of them chili bellies that will bother you once they're afoot." With that, he touched the spurs to his horse and trotted around to the other side of the herd. "Is that right?" Sean asked. "You're supposed to shoot at the horse?" "If Jake says so, it's right," Newt said loyally, though the advice had surprised him, too. "Have you shot many?" Sean asked. Newt shook his head. "Nope," he said. "Last night was the first time I even got to go. I never even shot at a man, or a horse, either." "You shoot the horse," Sean said when his brother Alan rode up. Alan said nothing. He was thinking of his little wife, Sari, whom he had left in Ireland. She had wept for weeks before he left, thinking it wrong that he should leave her. He had got his dander up and left anyway, and yet now he missed her so that tears as wet as hers sprang from his eyes almost every time he thought of her. Though normally a cheerful and even a merry man, the absence of Sari had affected him more than he had supposed anything could. In his mind's eye, he saw her small, red-headed figure moving through the chores of the day, now cooking spuds, now wringing milk from the tired teat of their old milk cow. He ignored all talk when he was thinking of Sari, refusing to let it distract him. How would she feel if she could know what he had gotten himself into, sitting on a horse with a heavy gun beneath his leg? On the other side of the herd, Augustus had finished separating out the prime stock and was about to divide up the crew. Dietz and Dish were holding the cut at a little distance from the main herd.
"Well, girls," Augustus said, "you might as well take these nags in and put them to bed. Me and this fine bunch of hands will ease the others upriver."
Dish Bogat could hardly believe his good fortune. He had been braced for a scratch night of brush busting, but it seemed old Gus had a mind to spare him.
"All right," he said. "Tell me what you want for supper, Gus, and I'll go eat it for you once we get these pinned."
Augustus ignored the sally.
"Dietz, you watch close," he said. "This young spark will probably have to go and get drunk, maybe married before the night's over."
Dish waved and started the horses. Just as he did, Jake came loping over. "Where are they going?" he asked.
"Back to town," Augustus said. Be the safest place for the good stock, I figure.
Why, damn, Jake said, plainly chagrined. You could have sent me back. I'm the one that's worn to a frazzle.
Somebody's got to help me protect these boys, Augustus said. As I recall, you made a name for yourself by shooting Mexican bandits. I thought you'd welcome the chance to polish your reputation a little.
I'd rather shoot you, Jake said, pretty grumpily. You caused me more hell than all the bandits in Mexico.
Now, Jake, be fair, Augustus said. He was just hoping to go back and get your bean and that girl again. I feel young Dish should have his shot before you ruin her completely.
Jake snorted. The young cowboy was the least of his worries. If you like these Irishmen so much, you watch them, he said. Send me little Newt. We'll take one side. Are we supposed to be going anywhere in particular?
No, Augustus said. Just try and keep him out of Mexico.
He waved at Newt, who soon came loping over.
Son, Jake Spoon has requested your help, he said. If you and him watch the east, me and P and the shortcakes will take the west.
The boy's face lit up as if he had just been given a new saddle. He had practically worshipped Jake Spoon once, and would clearly be willing to again, given the encouragement. Augustus felt a momentary pang. He liked Jake, but he felt him to be too leaky a vessel to hold so much hope. But then all vessels leak to some degree. Will we just keep riding, or will we stop and wait for the Mexicans? Newt asked, anxious to know the right thing to do.
Keep riding, Augustus said. Let them catch us if they're men enough. And if they do, try not to shoot up all your ammunition. We might need some tomorrow.
With that, he turned, and in a few minutes, with the inexpert help of the Irishman, got 100 horses moving north in the fading light.
Chapter 15.
The minute they got the herd penned, Dish felt himself getting restless. He had a smoke, leaning on the gate of the big corral. He knew that he had a clear duty to stay with the horses, though the darky was obviously a superior hand. He could hardly be expected to hold a place against a swarm of bandits. The problem was that Dish could not believe in the swarm of bandits. Under the red afterglow, the town was still as a church. Now and then there was a bleat of a goat or the call of a bull bat, but that was all. It was so peaceful that Dish soon convinced himself that there was no real need for two men to waste the whole evening in a dusty corral. The bandits were theoretical, but Lorena was real, and only 200 yards away. Leaning on the gate, Dish had no trouble imagining favorable possibilities. Jake Spoon was only human, and he was oversure of himself at that. He might have rushed a suit. Dish could understand it. He would have rushed one himself, had he known how. Perhaps Lori had not welcomed such boldness. Perhaps she had recognized that Jake was not a man to depend on. By the time he had mulled over the prospect for 30 minutes, Dish was in a fever. He had to have another shot, or else carry some sharp regrets with him up the trail. Some might think it irresponsible. Cap'n Call, for one, certainly would. But he could not stand all night in chunking distance of Lorena and not go see her.
Well, it all looks safe, he said to Dietz, who had seated himself against a big water trough, his rifle across his lap.
Quite so far, Dietz agreed.
I reckon it'll be some while before anything happens, if anything does, he said. I believe I'll just stroll over to the saloon and bathe my throat.
Yes, sir. You go along, Dietz said. I can look after the stock.
You just shoot if you need help, Dish said. I'll get back here in a minute if there's trouble.
He took his horse so he wouldn't be caught afoot in the event of trouble and went trotting off. Dietz was just as glad to see him leave, for the young man's restlessness made him an uncomfortable companion. It was not a restlessness other men could talk to. Only a woman could cure it. Dietz had had such restlessness once, and had no woman to cure it, but years and hard work had worn the edge off of it, and he could relax and enjoy the quiet of the night, if he was let alone. He liked sitting with his back against the water trough, listening to the horses settling themselves. From time to time, one would come to the trough and drink. sucking the water into its mouth in long draws. Across the pen, two horses were stamping and snorting nervously, but Dietz didn't get up to go look. Probably it was just a snake that had snaked too close to the pen. A snake wasn't going to fool with horses if it could help it. The possibility of attack didn't worry him. Even if a few vaqueros did make a pass at the town, they would be nervous, sure of being outgunned. He could sleep. He had the knack of going in and out of sleep easily and quickly, but despite the long night and day, he wasn't sleepy. Relaxing at times was as good as sleeping. A sleeping man would miss the best of the evening, and the moonrise as well. Dietz had always been partial to the moon, watched it often, thought about it much. To him, it was a more interesting and a more affecting thing than the sun, which shone on every day in much the same fashion. But the moon changed. It moved around the sky. It waxed and waned. On the nights when it rose full and yellow over the plains around Lonesome Dove, it seemed so close that a man could almost ride over with a ladder and step right onto it. Dietz had even imagined doing it a few times, propping a ladder against the old full moon, stepping on. If he did it, one thing was sure. Mr. Gus would have something to talk about for a long time. Dietz had to grin at the mere thought of how excited Mr. Gus would get if he took off and rode the moon, for he thought of it like a ride, something he might just do for a night or two when things were slow. Then, when the moon came back close to Lonesome Dove, he would step off and walk back home. It would surprise them all. Other times, though, the moon rose so high that Dietz had to come to his senses and admit that no man could really ride on it. When he imagined himself up there on the thin little hook that hung above him white as a tooth, he almost got dizzy from his own imagining and had to try harder to pay attention to what was happening on the ground. Still, when there was nothing to see around him but a few horses sucking water, he could always rest himself by watching the moon in the sky. He loved clear nights and hated clouds. When it was cloudy, he felt deprived of half the world. His fear of Indians, which was deep, was tied to his sense that the moon had powers that neither white men nor black men understood. He had heard Mr. Gus talk about the moon moving the waters, and though he had glimpsed the ocean many times by the Matagorda, he had not been able to get a sense of how the moon moved it. But he was convinced that Indians understood the moon. He had never talked with an Indian about it, but he knew they had more names for it than white people had, and that suggested a deeper understanding. The Indians were less busy and would naturally have more time to study such things. It had always seemed to Dietz that it was lucky for the whites that the Indians had never gained full control over the moon. He had dreamed once, after the terrible battle of Fort Phantom Hill, that the Indians had managed to move the moon over by one of those little low hills that were all over West Texas. And they had got it to pause by the edge of the mountain so they could leap their horses onto it. It still occurred to him at times that such a thing might have happened, and that there were Comanches or possibly Kiowa riding around on the moon. Often when the moon was full and yellow and close to the earth, he got the strong feeling that Indians were on it. It was a fearful feeling, one he had never discussed with any man. The Indians hated the whites, and if they got control of the moon, which was said to control the waters, then terrible things might happen. The Indians could have the moon suck all the water out of the wells and rivers, or else turn it all to salt like the ocean. That would be the end, and a hard end at that. But when the moon was just a little white hook, Dietz tended to lose his worries. After all, water was still sweet, except for an alkaline river or two, like the Pecos. Perhaps if the Indians got on the moon, they had fallen off. Sometimes Dietz wished that he could have had some schooling, so as to maybe learn the answers to some of the things that puzzled and intrigued him. Night and day itself was something to ponder. There had to be a reason for the sun to fall, lie hidden, and then rise again from the opposite side of the plain, and other reasons for the rain, the thunder, and the slicing north wind. He knew the big motions of nature weren't accidents. It was just that his life had not given him enough information to grasp the way of things. And yet the Indians, who could not even talk a normal language, seemed to understand more about it even than Mr. Gus, who could talk a passel about the motions of nature or anything else you wanted to hear talked about. Mr. Gus had even tried to tell him the world was round, though Dietz regarded that as just joking talk. But it was Mr. Gus who put his name on the sign so that everyone who could read would realize that he was a part of the outfit. It made up for a lot of joking. Dietz rested happily by the water trough, now and then glancing at the moon. The ground shadows hid him completely, and any vaquero foolish enough to try and slip in would get a sharp surprise. Dish himself got something of a surprise when he walked into the dry bean, for Lorena was not alone, as he had been imagining her to be. She sat at a table with Jasper Fant, a skinny little waddy from upriver. Dish had met Jasper once or twice and rather liked him, though at this time he would have liked him a lot better if he'd stayed upriver, where he belonged. Jasper had a sickly look to him, but, in fact, was as healthy as the next man and had an appetite to rival Gus McCrae's. "There's Dish," Lorena said, when he came in the door. "Now we can have a game." Lippy, as usual, was kibitzing, putting in his 2 cents worth, whether they were wanted or not.
"Not unless he's been to the bank, we can't," he said.
"Don't mean he can't take a hand," Jasper said, giving Dish a friendly nod. "We all got weaknesses," Lippy observed. "Wants is playing poker for credit. That's why he can't afford to pay his piano player an honest wage." Xavier endured these witticisms silently. He was in a worse mood than usual, and he knew why. Jake Spoon had come to town and promptly deprived him of a whore, an asset vital to an establishment such as his in an out-of-way place like Lonesome Dove. Many a traveler who might not ordinarily come that far would, because of Lori. There was no woman like her on the border. She was not friendly, but because of her, men came and stayed to drink away the night. He would not be likely to get another such whore. There were Mexican women as pretty, but few cowboys would ride the extra miles for a Mexican woman, those being plentiful in most parts of South Texas. Besides, he himself bought Lori once a week, if not more. Once in a period of restless enthusiasm, he had bought her 6 times in 5 days, after which, being ashamed of his extravagance, if not his lust, he abstained for 2 weeks. It was a happy convenience having Lori in the place, and a fine change from his wife, Teresa, who had been stingy with her favors and a bully to boot. Once Teresa had denied him anything resembling a favor for a period of 4 months, which was a painful thing. He had been required to hunt Mexican women himself during that period, and had come close to feeling the wrath of a couple of Mexican husbands. By contrast, Lori was restful, and he had come to love her. She did not exhibit the slightest fondness for him, but neither did she raise the slightest objection when he felt like buying her. A fact Lippy was deeply resentful of. She refused to be bought by Lippy at any price. Now Jake Spoon had spoiled it all, and the only way Xavier could vent his annoyance was by winning money from Jasper Fant, most of which he could never collect. "Where's Jake?" Lori asked, a shock to Dish. His hopes, which had been soaring as he walked through the dark to the saloon, flopped down to boot level. For her to inquire about the man so shamelessly bespoke a depth of attachment that Dish could barely imagine. It was not likely she would ever inquire at all about him, even if he stepped out the door and vanished for a year. "Why, Jake's with Gus and the boys," he said, sitting down to make the best face of it he could. It was not much of a face, for Lori had never seemed prettier to him. She had pushed up the sleeves of her dress, and when it came her turn to handle the cards, her white arms all but mesmerized him. He could hardly think to bet for watching Lori's arms and her firm lips. Her arms were plumpish, but more graceful than any Dish had ever seen. He could not think what he was doing. He wanted her so much, it caused him to play so badly that in an hour he had lost 3 months' wages. Jasper Fant fared no better. Whether from love of Lori or lack of skill, Dish didn't know. Didn't know and didn't care. All he was conscious of was that somehow he would have to outlast Jake, for there could be no woman for him except the one across the table. The very friendliness with which she treated him stung like a scorpion bite, for there was nothing special in it. She was almost as friendly to Lippy, a pure fool, with a hole in his stomach to boot. The card game soon became a torture for everyone but Lori, who had won hand after hand. It pleased her to think how surprised Jake would be when he came back and saw her winnings. He would know she wasn't helpless, at least. She had always liked playing cards and liked it even better now that it was all she had to do until Jake came back. She even liked Dish and Jasper a little. It was a relief not to have to hold herself out of the fun because of what they wanted. She knew they felt hopeless, but then she had felt hopeless enough times, waiting for them to work up their nerve or else borrow $2. Let them get a taste. "Dish, we might as well stop," Jasper said. "We'll barely get out of debt this year as it is."
"I'll take a hand," Lippy said. "I might be rusty, but I'm willing."
It was a house rule that Lippy was not allowed to gamble. His style was extravagant and his resources meager. Several times his life had been endangered when strangers discovered he had no means of paying them the sums that he had just lost. But Xavier had lost faith in house rule, since it had always been a house rule that Lorena was a whore, and now she wasn't anymore. If a whore could retire so abruptly, Lippy might as well play cards. "What's he going to pay me with when I win?" Lorena asked.
"Sweet music," Lippy said cheerfully. "I'll play your favorite song."
It was not much enticement, Lorena thought, since he played her favorite songs every time she came in the room, as it was, hoping his skill at the keyboard would finally move her to let him buy a poke. She wasn't about to start that, but she did play him a few hands. The cowboys were too sunk to even drink. The boys said goodnight to her politely, hoping she would think kindly of them, but she didn't. Boys didn't interest her as much as cards. Outside, Jasper paused in the street and had a smoke with Dish.
"Hired on yet?" Jasper asked.
He had a mustache no thicker than a shoestring and a horse that was not much thicker than the mustache.
"I think so," Dish said. "I'm working for these Hat Creek boys right now. They're thinking of getting up a drive."
"You mean they hire you to play cards?" Jasper asked. He fancied himself a joker.
"Oh, I was just resting," Dish said. "I'm helping their darky guard some stock."
"Guard it from what?"
"From the Mexicans we stole it from," Dish said. "Captain went off to hire a crew."
"Hell," Jasper said. "If the Mexicans knew the captain was gone, they'd come and take back Texas."
"I reckon not," Dish said.
He felt the remark was slightly insulting. The captain was not the only man in Texas who could fight.
"He can hire me if he wants to when he gets back," Jasper said.
"He probably will," Dish said. Jasper had a reputation for being reliable, if not brilliant. Though aware that Dish might be touchy on the subject, Jasper was curious about what had happened to change Lori so. He looked wishfully at the light in her window.
"That girl got married or what?" he asked. "Every time I jingle my money, she looked at me like she was ready to carve my liver."
Dish resented the question. He was not so coarse as to enjoy discussing Lori with just any man who happened to ask. On the other hand, it was hard to see Jasper Fant as a rival. He looked half-starved and probably was.
"It's a scoundrel named Jake Spoon," Dish said. "I reckon he's beguiled her."
"Oh, so that's it," Jasper said.
"I believe I've heard the name. A pistolero some kind, ain't he?"
"I wouldn't know what he is," Dish said in a tone that was meant to let Jasper know he had no great interest in discussing the matter further. Jasper took the hint, and the two of them rode over to the Hat Creek Pens in silence, their minds on the white-armed woman in the saloon. She was no longer unfriendly, but it seemed to both of them that things had gone a little better before the change.
Chapter 16.
By the end of the first day's hiring, Call had collected four boys, none of them yet 18. Young Bill Spettle, the one they called Swift Bill, was no older than Newt, and his brother Pete only a year older than Bill. So desperate were their family circumstances that Call was almost hesitant to take them. The widow Spettle had a brood of 8 children, Bill and Pete being the oldest. Ned Spettle, the father of Moll, had died of drink 2 years before. It looked to Call as if the family was about to starve out. They had a little creek bottom farm not far north of Pickles Gap, but the soil was poor, and the family had little to eat but sow belly and beans. The widow Spettle, however, was eager for him to take the boys, and would hear no protest from Call. She was a thin woman with bitter eyes. Call had heard from someone that she had been raised rich in the East, with servants to comb her hair and help her into her shoes when she got up. It might have just been a story, but it was hard for him to imagine a grown-up who would need to be helped into their own shoes. But even if part of it was true, she had come a long way down. Ned Spettle had never got around to putting a floor in the shack of a house he built. His wife was rearing 8 children on the bare dirt. He had heard it said that Ned had never got over the war, which might have explained it. Plenty hadn't. It accounted for the shortage of grown men of a certain age, that war. Call himself felt a kind of guilt at having missed it, though the work he and Gus had done on the border had been just as dangerous and just as necessary. "Take 'em," the widow Spettle said, looking at her boys as if she wondered why she'd borne them. "I reckon they'll work as hard as any." Call knew the boys had helped take a small herd to Arkansas. He paid the widow a month's wage for each boy, knowing she would need it. There was evidently not a shoe in the family. Even the mother was barefoot, a fact that must shame her, if the servant's story was true. He didn't take the Spettle boys with him, for he had brought no spare horses, but the boys started at once for Lonesome Dove on foot, each of them carrying a blanket. They had one pistol between them, a Navy Colt with half its hammer knocked off. Though Call assured them that he would equip them well once they got to Lonesome Dove, they wouldn't leave the gun. "We've never shot any other gun," Swift Bill said, as if that meant they couldn't. When he took his leave, Mrs. Spettle and the 6 remaining children scarcely noticed him. They stood in the hot yard with a scrawny hen or two scratching around their bare feet, watching the boys and crying. The mother, who had scarcely touched her sons before they left, stood straight up and cried. 3 of the children were girls, but the other 3 were boys in their early teens, old enough, at least, to be of use to their mother. "We'll take good care of them," Call said, wasting words. The young girls hung onto the widow's frayed skirts and cried. Call rode on, though with a bad feeling in his throat. It was better that the boys go. There was not enough work for them there, and yet they were the pride of the family. He would take as good a care of them as he could, and yet what did that mean, with a drive of 2,500 miles to make? He made the Rainey Ranch by sundown, a far more cheerful place than the Spettle homestead. Joe Rainey had a twisted leg, the result of an accident with a buckboard, but he got around on one leg almost as fast as a healthy man. Call was not as fond of Ma, Joe's fat, red-faced wife, as Augustus was, but then he had to admit he was not as fond of any woman as Augustus was. Maud Rainey was built like a barrel, with a bosom as big as buckets and a voice that some claimed would make hair fall out. It was the general consensus around Lonesome Dove that if she and Augustus had married, their combined voices would have deafened whatever children they might have produced. She talked at the table like some men talked when they were driving mules. Still, she and Joe had managed to produce an even dozen children so far, 8 of them boys and all of them strapping. Among them, the Raineys probably ate as much food in one meal as the Spettles consumed in a week. As near as Call could determine, they all devoted most of their waking hours to either growing or butchering or catching what they ate. Augustus's blue pigs had been purchased from the Raineys, and they were the first thing Maud thought to inquire about when Call rode up. "Have you et that shoat yet?" Maud asked before he could even dismount. "No, we ain't," Call said. "I guess Gus is saving him for Christmas, or else he just likes to talk to him." "Well, step down and have a wash at the bucket," Maud said. "I'm cooking one of that shoat's cousins right this minute." It had to be admitted that Maud Rainey set a fine table. Call had no sooner got his sleeves rolled up and his hands clean than supper began. Joe Rainey just had time to mumble a prayer before Maud started pushing around the cornbread. Call was faced with more meats than he had seen on one table since he could remember. Beefsteak and pork chops, chicken and venison, and a stew that appeared to contain squirrel and various less familiar meats. Maud got red in the face when she ate, as did everyone else at the table, from the steam rising off their platters.
This is my varmint stew, Captain, Maud said.
Oh, he asked politely, what kind of varmints?
Whatever the dogs catch, Maud said, or the dogs themselves, if they don't manage to catch nothing, I won't support a lazy dog.
She put a possum in, one of the little girls said. She seemed as full of mischief as her fat mother, who, fat or not, made plenty of mischief among the men of the area before she settled on Joe.
Now, Maggie, don't be giving away my recipes, Maud said. Anyway, the captain's likely ate possum before.
At least it ain't goat, Call said, trying to make conversation. It was an unfamiliar labor, since at his own table he mostly worked at avoiding it. But he knew women liked to talk to their guests, and he tried to fit into the custom.
We've heard a rumor that Jake is back and on the run, Joe Rainey said. He wore a full beard, which at the moment was shiny with pork drippings. Joe had a habit of staring straight ahead. Though Call assumed he had a neck joint like other men, he had never seen him use it. If you happened to be directly in front of him, Joe would look you in the eye, but if you were positioned a little to one side, his look went floating on by.
Yes, Jake arrived, Call said. He's been to Montana and says it's the prettiest country in the world.
It's probably filled with women, then, Maud said. I remember Jake. He can't find a woman, he gets so restless he'll scratch.
Call saw no need to comment on Jake's criminal status, if any. Fortunately, the Rainies were too busy eating to be very curious. The children, who had been well brought up, didn't try for the better meats, but made do with a platter of chicken and some fryback and cornbread. One little tad, evidently the runt of the family, got nothing but cornbread and chicken gizzards, but he knew better than to complain. With 11 brothers and sisters all bigger than him, complaint would have been dangerous.
"Well, what's Gus up to?" Maud asked. "I've been sitting here waiting for him to come over and try and take me away from Joe, but I don't guess he's coming. Has he still got his craving for buttermilk?"
"Yes. He drinks it by the gallon," Call said. "I fancy it myself, so we compete." He felt Maud's statement not in the best of taste, but Joe Rainey continued to stare straight ahead and drip into his beard. Call finally asked if he could hire a couple of boys. Maud sighed and looked down her double row of children.
"I'd rather sell pigs than hire out boys," she said. "But I guess they've got to see the world sometime."
"What's the pay?" Joe asked, always the practical man.
"Why, $40 and found, I reckon," Call said. "Of course we'll furnish the mounts."
That night he slept in a wagon in the Rainey's yard. He had been offered a place in the loft, but it was piled so high with children that he hardly trusted himself in it. Anyway, he preferred the out-of-doors, though the out-of-doors at the Rainey's was more noisy than he was used to. The pigs grunted all night looking for lizards or something to eat. Then there was a barn owl that wouldn't stop calling, so he had a time getting to sleep. The next morning, he got a promise from Maud that her two oldest boys would get themselves to Lonesome Dove by the end of the week. The boys themselves, Jimmy and Ben Rainey, scarcely said a word. Call rode off feeling satisfied, believing he had enough of a crew to start gathering cattle. Word would get out, and a few more men would probably trickle in. They had to get the cattle and get them branded. At least they had the luxury of surplus horses. Or did, if Gus and Jake hadn't contrived to fiddle around and lose them. He worried about that possibility most of the way home. Not that Gus wasn't competent. So far as sheer ability went, Gus was as competent as any man he'd ever known. There had been plenty of times when he wondered if he himself could match Gus, if Gus really tried. It was a question that never got tested, because Gus seldom tried. As a team, the two of them were perfectly balanced. He did more than he needed to, while Gus did less. Gus himself often joked about it.
"If you got killed, I might work harder," he said. "I might get in a righteous frame of mind if I had that stimulation. But you ain't killed, so what's the point?"
Call wasted no time getting back, wishing all the way that he had the mare. She had spoiled him, made him too aware of the limitations of his other mounts. The fact that she was dangerous made him like her more.
She made him extra watchful, which was good. When he got within 15 miles of Lonesome Dove, he cut west, thinking they would be holding the herd in that direction. He rode around the southern edge of the bad brush country and struck the trail of the horses. They had been going back south over their own tracks, which was curious. Gus had taken them back to town. Probably he had a reason, but it was not one Call could guess, so he loped on home. When he approached the town, he saw the horses grazing upriver a little ways, with Dietz and Newt and the Irishman holding him. They looked to be all there, so evidently nothing had happened. One thing about Gus McCrae, he was easily found. By 3 in the afternoon, any afternoon, he would be sitting on the porch, drawing occasionally from his jug. When Call rode up, he was sitting there taking a nap. There was no sign of Jake. "You're a fine guard," he said, dismounting. Augustus had his hat over his eyes, but he removed it and looked at Call. "How's Maud Rainey?" he asked. "She's in good health," Call said. "She fed me twice." "Good thing it was just twice," Augustus said. "If you'd stayed a week, you'd have had to rent an ox to get home on." "She's anxious to sell you some more pigs," Call said, taking the jug and rinsing his mouth with whiskey. "If Joe was to get killed, I might court her again," Augustus speculated. "I hope you will," Call said. "Them 12 young ones ought to have a good father. What are the horses doing back here so soon?" "Wild grazing, most likely," Augustus said. "Didn't Pedro make a try?" "No, he didn't, and for a very good reason," Augustus said. "And what reason would that be?" "'Cause he died," Augustus said. "Well, I swear," Carl said, stunned. "Is that the truth?" "I ain't seen the corpse, but I imagine it's true. Jasper Fant rode in looking for work and had the news. Though the scamp didn't give it to me until I had wasted most of the night." "I wonder what killed him," Carl said. "Pedro Flores had been a factor in their lives off and on for 30 years, though probably they had not actually seen him more than 6 or 7 times. It was surprising hearing that he was gone, and though it should have been a relief, it wasn't exactly. It was too much of a surprise."
"Jasper wasn't up on the details," Augustus said. "He just heard it from a vaquero. But I allow it's true because it explains why you could lope in with a boy and an idiot and saunter off with his remuda."
"Well, I swear," Carl said again. "I never expected that."
"Oh, well," Augustus said. "I never either. But then I don't know why not. Mexicans don't have no special dispensation. They die like the rest of us. I expect Bo will die one of these days, and then we won't have nobody to whack that dinner bell with a crowbar."
"Pedro was tough, though," Carl said. After all, the man had more or less held nearly 100-mile stretch of the border for nearly 30 years. Call had known many men who died, but somehow had not expected it of Pedro, though he himself had fired several bullets at him. "I'd like to know what took him," Call said.
"He might have choked on a pepper," Augustus said. "Them that can't be killed by knives or bullets usually break their necks, falling off the porch or something. Remember Johnny Norvell, dying of that bee sting? I guess Johnny had been shot 20 times, but a darn bee killed him."
It was true. The man had rangered with them, and yet the bee sting had given him a seizure of some kind, and no one could bring him out of it.
"Well, it will about finish the Flores operation," Augustus said. "He just had 3 boys, and we hung the only one of them, then he'd get up and go."
To Augustus's surprise, Carl sat down on the porch and took a big swallow from the jug. He felt curious, not sick, but suddenly empty. It was the way a kick in the stomach would make you feel. It was an odd thing, but true, that the death of an enemy could affect you almost as much as the death of a friend. He had experienced it before, when news reached them that Kicking Wolf was dead. Some young soldier on his second patrol had made a lucky shot and killed him on the Clear Fork of the Brazos.
and Kicking Wolf had kept two companies of Rangers busy for 20 years, killed by a private. Call had been shoeing a horse when P brought him that piece of news. He had felt so empty for a spell that he had to put off finishing the job. That had been 10 years ago, and he and Gus soon quit rangering. So far as Call was concerned, the death of Kicking Wolf meant the end of the Comanches, and thus the end of their real job. There were other chiefs, true, and the final fights were yet to be fought, but he had never had the vengeful nature of some rangers and had no interest in spending a decade mopping up renegades and stragglers. Pedro Flores was a far cry from being the fighter Kicking Wolf had been. Pedro seldom rode out without 20 or 30 vaqueros to back him up, whereas Kicking Wolf, a small man no bigger than a boy, would raid San Antonio with 5 or 6 braves and manage to carry off 3 women and scare all the whites out of 7 or 8 counties just by traveling through them. But Pedro was of the same time and had occupied them just as long.
"I didn't know you liked that old bandit so much," Augusta said.
"I didn't like him," Call said. "I just didn't expect him to die."
"He probably never expected it either," Augusta said. "He was a rough old cob."
After a few minutes, the empty feeling passed, but Call didn't get to his feet. The sense that he needed to hurry, which had been with him most of his life, had disappeared for a space. "We might as well go on to Montana," he said. "Fun's over around here." Augustus snorted, amused by the way his friend's mind worked.
"Call, there never was no fun around here," he said. "And besides, you never had no fun in your life. You wasn't made for fun. That's my department."
"I used the wrong word, I guess," Call said.
"Yes, but why did you?" Augustus said. "That's the interesting part."
Call didn't feel like getting drawn into an argument, so he kept quiet.
"First you run out of Indians, and now you've run out of bandits. That's the point," Augustus said. "You've got to have somebody to outwit, don't you?"
"I don't know why I need anybody when I got you," Call said.
"I don't see why we just don't take over northern Mexico now that Pedro's dead. It's just down the darn street. And I'm sure there's still a few folks down there who'd give you a fight."
"I don't need to fight," Call said. "Won't hurt us to make some money."
"It might," Augustus said. "I might drown in the Republican River like that Pumphrey boy. Then you'd get all the money, and you wouldn't even know how to have fun with it. You'd probably use it to buy gravestones for old bandits that you happen to like."
"If you drown in the Republican River, I'll give you your part to Jake," Call said. "I guess he'd know how to spend it." With that, he mounted and rode off, meaning to find Jasper Fant and hire him if he really wanted to work.
Chapter 17.
By the time Jake Spoon had been in Lonesome Dove 10 days, Lorena knew she had a job to do. Namely, the job of holding him to his word and making sure he took her to San Francisco as he had promised to do. Of course, Jake had not given her any direct notice that he intended to do differently. He moved in with her immediately and was just as pleasant about everything as he had been the first day. He had not taken a cent of money from her, and they seldom passed an hour together without him complimenting her in some way, usually on her voice or her looks, or the fine texture of her hair, or some delicacy of manner. He had a way of appearing always mildly surprised by her graces, and if anything, his sentiments only grew warmer as they got to know one another better. He repeated several times his dismay at her having been stuck for so long in a dismal hole like Lonesome Dove. But after a week, Lorena became aware of a curious thing. Jake was more attached to her than she was to him. The fact struck her late one afternoon while she was watching him nap. He had insisted on a route and gone right to sleep afterward. While the sweat was cooling on them, she realized she wasn't excited about him in the way she had been the first day. The first day had been one of the big days of her life because of the smooth way Jake had shown up and taken over.
ending her long period of tension and discomfort. She still felt peaceful with him. They had never quarreled, and he had not demonstrated the slightest inclination to meanness. But it was clear to her already that he was one of those men somebody had to take care of. He had fooled her for a few days into thinking that he would do the taking care of, but that wasn't so. He was a clever card player and could make money, but that was just part of it. Jake had to have company. When he slept, or when he was amused, or was just lolling around telling stories, the childish part of him showed, and it was a big part. Before the week was over, it seemed to her that he was all play. The realization didn't disturb her calm, though. It meant he needed her more than he would admit. She recognized the need and didn't care whether he admitted it or not. If Jake had been as firm as he pretended to be, it would have left her with little security. He could have just walked off. But he wouldn't. He liked talk, woman's talk, and the comforts of the bed. He even liked it that she lived above the saloon, since it meant a game was handy if he felt like playing. Since the Hat Creek outfit had been gathering cattle and getting ready for their drive, games were handier than they had been for a while. Several cowboys drifted in a Lonesome Dove looking for work. Some of them had enough snap left at night to wander in and cut the cards. A tall cowboy named Needle Nelson showed up from north of San Antonio, and a cheerful cowboy from Brownsville named Bert Borum. At first, Xavier was cheered by all the new customers, until it occurred to him that they would only be there for a week or two. Then the thought of how empty the saloon would soon be filled him with gloom, and he stood by the door most of the night, his wash rag dripping down his leg. Lippy was kept plenty busy, for the cowboys were always requesting songs. Lippy liked the company. He was proud of his talent at the keyboard and would pound out any song that was requested. Jake took pains to teach Lorena a few things about card playing that she didn't know. She came to wonder how Jasper and Bert and Needle Nelson got by on so little sleep, for the captain worked them hard all day and the games went on half the night. The only cowboy likely to pull a sour face if she sat in was Dish Bogart, who wouldn't get over being in love with her. It amused her that he sat there looking so solemn, with his big mustache. Jake did not even seem to notice that the man was in love with her. She was tempted to tease Jake a little, but he had told her plain out he was a jealous man. For all she knew, he might shoot Dish, which would be a pity. Dish was nice enough. It was just that he couldn't compare with Jake Spoon. When the gathering and branding of the cattle had been going on for about 10 days, Lorena began to feel a crisis coming. She heard the cowboys speculate that the branding would be done in another week, which meant that they were close to starting the drive. The boys were saying that they were already late. "Hell, we'll be crossing the Yellowstone on the darn ice if we don't get started," Needle Nelson said. He was a funny-looking man, thin as a wire, with an Adam's apple that looked as big as a turkey egg. "Why, I doubt we'll make the Yellowstone," Jasper Fant said. "Most of us will get drowned before we get that far." "Needle won't," Dish Bogart suggested. "There ain't a river up that way deep enough he couldn't walk through it and not get his hat wet." "I can swim anyway," Needle remarked. "I'd like to see you swim with 50 or 60 cattle on top of you, or maybe your own horse," Jasper said. "Ain't no 50 or 60 cattle gonna be on top of me," Needle replied, unruffled. "No darn horse, neither." Bert Borum thought Needle was hilarious. He thought pretty near everything was hilarious. He was one of those men who have a laugh you like to hear. "I'm getting me a float before I cross any river," he declared. "What kind of float?" Dish inquired. "Ain't decided," Bert said. "Might tie a few jugs to my horse. Jugs are good floats." "Where would you get a darn jug on a cattle drive?" Jasper asked. "If the captain was to catch you with the jug, he'd want to know who drank the whiskey out of it." Jake was tolerant of the cowboys, but careful to keep himself a bit apart from them. He never chimed in when they talked about the life they would have on the trail. He never spoke to Lorena about the fact that the herd would be leaving in 10 days. He didn't work much on the branding, either. though once in a while he spent a night helping them gather more stock. Mostly he let it appear that the drive had nothing to do with him. Lorena didn't press him, but she kept an eye on him. If he wanted to stay, that was one thing, but if he planned on going, he was going to have to figure a way to take her. He wasn't leaving without her, whatever he might think about the matter. Then before the issue came to a head, something happened that took Lorena completely unaware. It was a blistering day, and the saloon totally empty except for Lippy. Xavier, who had a taste for fish, had gone off to the river to see if he could catch any. Lorena was sitting at a table practicing one or two card tricks Jake had taught her, when who should walk in but Gus. His shirt was wet from sweat as if he'd been underwater a week, and even his hat band was sweated through. He went around behind the bar and got himself a bottle and brought it over to the table, grinning, a big grin despite the heat. She noticed that he had brought her a glass, which struck her as bold, but then Gus would do anything, as Jake was always saying.
"What I can't figure out is why there ain't but two sinners in this saloon," Gus said.
Lorena made no comment, but Lippy piped up.
"I've tried to sin all my life. Ain't you gonna count me?" he asked. "No, you got a hole in your stomach," Augusta said. "You paid for yours, but so far me and Lori have got off scot-free."
Gus poured a little whiskey in her glass and filled his just below the brim.
"I want a poke," he said,
as casual as if he were asking her to loan him two bits. Lorena was so taken aback that she didn't know what to say. She looked at Lippy, who was just sitting there listening, as if it were his right. Gus, of course, was not the slightest bit embarrassed by what he was suggesting. He took his hat off and hung it on the chair, looking at her pleasantly. Lorena felt sorely at a loss. She had never expected Gus to commit such a blunder, for it was well known that he and Jake were good friends. Gus must know that Jake was living with her, and yet he walked in and asked, as if it made no difference. She sat silent, showing her puzzlement, which only seemed to amuse Gus.
"I wish you wouldn't sit there thinking about it," he said. "Just sell me a poke and be done with it. I hate to sit and watch a woman think."
"Why?" she asked, finding her voice again. She felt the beginnings of indignation. "I guess I got the right to think if I want to," she added. Gus just grinned.
"Oh, you got the right," he said. "It's just that it's fearsome for a man to have a woman start thinking right in front of him. It always leads to trouble."
He paused and drank a healthy swallow of whiskey. "I'm with Jake now," Lorena said, merely stating the obvious.
"Well, I know that, honey," Augusta said. "The minute I looked up the road and seen Jake coming, I knew you and him had settled in. Jake's a good hand to settle in with, I admit. A sight better than me. But the fact is, he went out to the cow camp at the wrong time, and Carl put him to work. Carl don't appreciate Jake's restful qualities like you and me do. He's been fretting for a week because Jake wasn't working. Now that he's got him, you can bet he'll keep him a day or two."
Lorena looked at Lippy, wishing he wasn't there, but Lippy sat, astonished at what he was hearing. His lip hung down like a flap of some kind. It always did when he forgot himself.
"Jake ain't got the stuff to stand up to call," Augusta said. "He's gonna have to stay out there and brand dogies for a while. So there ain't no reason for you not to sell me a poke."
"I told you the reason," Lorena said. "Jake takes care of me now," she added.
"No, he don't," Gus said. "You take care of him."
It was the very truth that Lorena had discovered for herself, and it stumped her that Gus would not only know it, but come right out with it as if it were an ordinary fact.
"Jake Spoon has never taken care of nobody," Gus said. "Not even himself. He's the world's child, and the main point about him is that he'll always find somebody to take care of him. It used to be me and Carl, but right now it's you. That's fine and good, but it's no reason you should go out of business entirely. You can sell me a poke and still take care of Jake."
Lorena knew that was true as far as it went. Jake was not hard to take care of, and probably not hard to fool. It wouldn't enter his head that she would sell a poke, now that she had him. He had plenty of pride and not a little vanity. It was one of those things she liked about him. Jake thought well of his looks. He was not a dressy man like Tinkersley.